They say plants like music.
Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
All right, we are back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm one-time Oscars fan, Louis Fertel. I am now an Oscars survivor, Louis Fertel.
Well, let me tell you something about the Oscars. This year was the first Black Oscars in a lot of ways.
Oh.
So we had to, of course, bring Damon Young on the show to guest co-host with us. Hi, Jay.
and you know, I was scheduled to co-host before the Oscars all of a sudden turned into the Source Awards. So again, it's just very, very advantageous, very, very serendipitous that, you know, that the schedules worked out where I'm here 2 days after the slap heard around the world.
See, that is an appropriate descriptor, by the way. The calling it the Source Awards. I would say that the immediate way to tell if white people were racist online, if they were writing, this felt like the BET Awards. And I'm like, the BET Awards don't have fighting at them. The Source Awards, however, plenty of fights.
Yeah. And also, we can make that joke. Like, I yeah. They're so, and that's one of the beauties of being Black in America and also consuming a thing like this is that there's just a wider range of jokes that we are able to tell. And this is why I'm writing a book about this, about why Black American humor is the best American humor. It's because we just have more material and we're also allowed to access all of the material. Right. So
another book already. Slow down, David.
I mean, it's been
R.L. Stein over here.
It's been three years. You know, it's been 3 years. You see this exposed piping in the background. I gotta pay for that somehow. So I gotta keep churning them out.
Now, is anybody concerned with the phraseology, the slap heard around the world, that we are erasing Stephen and Irene from the real world Seattle?
You know what? That's a good question, because that was a serious slap that
and also a more traditional slap in that, like, you know, like a quote unquote bitch slap. Whereas what actually, obviously we'll get into this in a second, is what the whole episode will obviously end up being about. But what Will Smith did, it is a slap, but the impact was more than a slap. So it's almost like we need to coin something new for whatever it was.
Yeah, this is almost like a hyper slap. Because it and again, just going back to, you know, like even jokes and permissions and all of the weird nebulous politics that exists around that, I think that when you have male on male violence like that, there is a wider range of things to talk about, or there's a wider range of things to joke about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, this is funnier,
yes,
than the real world slap, mm-hmm, because it was a Black, yes, man slapping a woman. White woman, is she white?
I think, yes, she's white. You're right.
White, mm-hmm, white, yeah. And white and annoying. Just to get that out of the way, she was annoying back then. She's less annoying now. I will say that the real world slap offered a lot more twists and turns, because the whole slap was because she kept referring to him as gay, and he was like, I'm not gay. Then he slapped her, and then what, 20 years later, when like the big Real World reunion aired with all of the cities on MTV, he was there with his partner, because of course he was gay. And she was right.
Maybe, you know, I think sometimes people, you know, they you know, they say, you know, I'm gonna slap the gay out of you. Maybe the gay was slapped into him when he did that. Like, I don't know.
It's like a reverse exorcism. Now you're filled with the gay.
Now you're filled with the gay after you commit the act of violence. So, so you know, good for him.
All right. Well, we've got plenty of Oscars to talk about. Damon is here, so we're also going to talk about this piece that you wrote on Jack Harlow, who I love. But we'll get into that. Jack Harlow starring in a reboot of White Men Can't Jump, which also ties back into the Oscars because they celebrated the anniversary of it for some damn reason. We'll get into all of that. It's going to be a whole Oscars episode. And then also, Lewis and I have a convo with the wonderful Judith Light this episode as well.
Oh, my God. And does she bring it? She goes 150 miles an hour and we are, you know, panting as we try to keep up with her.
She's faster than the speed of the slab, actually. So there's a lot. There's a lot going on.
Hey, the speed of Judith Light.
Oh, my God.
It's right there.
Listen to this copy editor writing this rad headline right there.
All right. We will be back with more Keeper. Check out the latest episode of Offline with YouTube sensation and former late night host Lily Singh.
This week, she joins John to talk about what being on late night meant to her, why she decided to delete social media off her phone, and how she learned to be alone with her thoughts. New episodes of Offline drop every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
That is if you want to listen to John Favreau on another podcast.
Can't relate.
Well, we thought maybe after weeks of discussing the Oscars, we could move on now that they're over. But then Will Smith slapped that possibility away. And I want to first bring up two things addressed to Lewis. Okay. One, maybe this is your fault because a friend of mine, my friend Tom, was sending me a text about how he was catching up on last week's Keep It. And he said when we were discussing our picks for who was going to win, you said of the five lead actor nominees, who slapped?
Whoa. I don't claim psychic abilities, but okay, I'm happy to own it now.
You manifested the slap.
You manifested it. And two, Lewis, have you ever been slapped before?
Good question. Well, let me tell you something. About 10 years ago, I did a little bit with my only very close friends where if they said something even remotely, quote unquote, offensive to me, I would jokingly slap them. I remember our friend Tony said that Meryl Streep had been nominated for She-Devil. Well, guess what came out? My hand. And so that was like a bit I did for a second. And guess what? That bit is also, people get over it really quickly. So I moved on from it. But have I ever been slapped? Maybe in a play I did.
I vaguely remember this bit. Yeah. I do remember I was never slapped.
No, that's true. You weren't. No, you know what? I don't know that I've been slapped. I don't think so.
No one slapped you in retaliation to your bit?
No, you are correct. My friend Morgan Polakoff did because he said I was from Joliet, Illinois. Not true. I'm from Lamont, and I got a little palm happy, shall we say? Yeah.
Okay. And see, Damon, that is the difference between the races. You know, I don't playfully slap my friends because I would have gotten knocked out.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, what's your name from the world say? I don't wrestle. I beat bitches up, and that's that. I don't fight. Like, I haven't been in an actual fight since I was like 13 years old, right? Like an actual fist fight. Now I've been in basketball related scuffles and elbows thrown and shit talk, but actual like we're squaring up, we're fighting. That hasn't happened in a long time because I feel like most people exist on opposite ends of the fighting spectrum where like either you've been in 29 fights since you were a kid or you just fought in a Costco's parking lot like last weekend, or you've been in zero. Like no one has been in like three fights. and so yeah, I mean the slapping is just not a thing that is a part of my life. I don't play slap. I don't get play slapped. I did get a drink thrown very viciously in my direction, and not like thrown, but like the drink was like shoved into my chest by someone who was unhappy with a decision that I made. But in terms of actual, you know, a face, a hand hitting my face, an open hand hitting my face, that, yeah, that it's been, I'd have to go back to like my mom maybe hitting me. And my mom didn't hit me frequently, but she did once when I was like 11. All right. And that's, yeah.
Getting a drink pushed on you, though, that's an appropriation of the television series Smash Culture, which we can unpack that later. Specifically, what's Eileen Rand, Angelica Houston's character. Yes.
I would say the same. Fighting used to be a part of my life in the sense that I went to public school in Milwaukee. And so I definitely saw, you know, like you would step onto the playground and there'd be morning fights, you know? So I am used to it in that respect. But I don't think I've been in a fight since I was younger. I mean, most fights, arguments that I've been in have stayed, you know, sort of verbal in my adult life, mostly because, and this is a thing that the Will Smith slap brought up on Twitter, which was fair. A lot of people, one, act like they have never been around violence in their lives, which, you know, if you're white saying this, I know at least two of your cousins fought with somebody at a store because they had to put on a mask. So you know people who get violent regularly. You've seen white people be violent on planes. You've seen white dads get like kicked out of their kids' sports games. Like it is a thing that happens. So pretending it was like the most shocking thing you've ever seen in the world was really something. But I think also people in this Twitter age tweet such reckless things at each other or about people, and there isn't that threat of violence. And so that's why it was sort of shocking to them. Like, I've run into people, Lewis, you know, at like Akbar, who might have like tweeted something crazy at me, you know? There's no expectation on their part, though, that I'm going to hit them in the face because they did that, even though they probably deserve it. And if you did that, they would never do it again.
Well, I will say, I think what is shocking about this slap, other than, I mean, nobody expected to see it. I'm certain Nicole Kidman did not expect to be 5 feet from a slap, for example. To me, what was surprising was you only realized in retrospect it happened. Because to me, the crazy thing about it was he was out of his chair so fast. It was like Robin Williams doing a bit at the Oscars where you're like, oh, this person's animated and they're like friends. Like, obviously, Will Smith and Chris Rock know each other. So to only realize afterwards that it had happened while Will Smith was doing the yelling, that to me is the shocking thing. Because you can see it even registering on, I think, Lupita Nyong'o's face.
She thought it was a joke.
I think she thinks it's a joke. Yeah, that's what people are looking at.
And then her face slowly starts to go to, oh, yeah. I like when things started cutting out, I had no idea what was really happening. Wow. And then the anger in his voice when he said, keep my wife's name out your fucking mouth, is when I knew it was real. And I do want to point out that I immediately knew that this was personal from Jada's face at the G.I. Jane joke, which was one, ad-libbed. It's been proven that it felt ad-libbed anyway, but it's been proven it was ad-libbed. But two, if we go back to 2016, and this is right, my actual main problem with the whole fight in general, and why I'm actually angrier at Chris Rock in this situation, is in 2016, when he hosted the Oscars, that was when Jada and Will were sitting out the Oscars, the concussion year for the, you know, Oscars So White campaign. And he was making jokes online about Jada staying at home. Like, how are you going to protest something that you're not even invited to? Making jokes about a black woman not being invited to the Oscars in a room full of white people who then laughed about it. People who were like her peers, people who were Will's peers. And I found that embarrassing on his part and rude that he would do that to her. Full disclosure, I wrote an article about that for MTV News in 2016, and then Jada did send me flowers.
Oh, okay.
She did. Yeah.
It was a lazy, hacky joke. Right. And also not just the fact that, you know, he has this ad lib joke about Jada Pinkett Smith. I mean, okay, so you're Chris Rock, you're in this, you're hosting, you're one of the presenters for the Oscars. There are, what, 4,000 people there? I don't know how many people are in the theater. Jada Pinkett Smith is probably the 117th most famous person there. Right. Now, yes. she is more Black people famous than she is mainstream famous. She has a name. Right. And so when you are hosting a thing like that, you, if you're going to talk shit about people, you go at the super duper stars. You know what I mean? You don't just. And I feel like that is the part that I haven't seen discussed that much. It's like, you know, the other people who, you know, who Amy Schumer and who else? It was Wanda Sykes
and Regina Hall.
Regina Hall. We're going at were like Sandra Bullock, okay, Harvey Bardem, you know, people who are nominated, people who are superstars, right? Mm-hmm. And again, I think that, you know, Chris saw Jada. It was an easy, hacky, lazy joke to make. You know what I mean? And I think that, you know, just getting back to our reaction to that, and I had a really awkward experience of witnessing it, because I was watching Oscars live, but I had put it on pause for something. My wife and I were talking about something, we just put it on pause, so we were about 2 minutes behind. And so I'm watching, you know, I'm watching Chris Rock start his monologue, or about to start his monologue, and people are texting me like, what the fuck is that? Like, I my phone felt like a Cheesecake Factory buzzer when you're right. And then, you know, I'm like, holy shit, something is about to happen. Right. And then I see the slap. And I think that one of the things that made it so jarring is that, you know, Chris Rock's reaction, because, you know, even when we slow it down and we watch like the Zapruder, you know, Chinese films of it right now, his expression doesn't change. Until like the millisecond before he is slapped, there's no recognition of, oh, this 6'3", 220-pound man is approaching me about to do violence. Like, there's none of that in him. It's almost like he is still he thinks it's a bit. And I think we took his cue from that and was like, okay, this must be, oh, wait, what? And then to Chris Rock's credit, this dude has the strongest chin. I want to have a love as strong as Chris Rock's chin. Because again,
how was he not played Batman? Truly, the chin that was like it took so much.
Yeah, he got hit very hard. And he took a step back and then went right back into doing his job. He didn't say, he didn't even say, ow. He didn't touch his face. He didn't do anything like that. He just went right back.
He was like, Will Smith just slapped the shit out of me.
Right. He did not register any pain. He went into just pure shock. And then I think was waiting for teleprompter feed to just get to the award, which finally happened. And then he delivered the best documentary thing. And by the way, I just want to say Questlove gave such a great speech after that. And that was so props to him for like remembering what he was going to say.
And I feel like someone like him with a mouth like his and his size is used to being slapped. Like and so he reacted like someone like, this is happening again.
I will say that largely my anger goes back to, I mean, people kept sharing that clip after this that we talked about before on the show where Chris Rock is talking about the N-word with Jerry Seinfeld and Ricky Gervais and Louis C.K. and is like just sit, like laughing while the awful people in the clip say the N-word, and Jerry Seinfeld's just sort of like, I've never found the humor in it, and I don't ever want to, you know. And it's just that he and Will are sort of like rich Black people from the same coin, you know. They're like going towards this big success in these white fields, and it's sort of like changed how they interact with each other and where their egos were coming from. Because you were right, picking on Jada, who was like the 117th most famous person in that room right then,
and I wasn't
wild.
Saying that. And I want to say real quick, I wasn't saying that to shade Jada Pinkett Smith.
No, I get that. She's
a huge fan, but you know, in that room, in that
car. Yes. In that room, it was wild to do that. It actually would have been wild even if she were one of the more fake, even if she were like in that room, like the 15th most famous, only because she is the wife of a nominee and she's coming to support her husband. And you know, it's like you wouldn't make a joke dragging Rita Wilson being like, you could make jokes about Rita Wilson showing up to the opening of an envelope, you know, because that's what she does. Mm-hmm. She's got to be everywhere. But I just think that compounded with how he dogged her out in front of white people in 2016. It was just sort of like, enough is enough. And him like being like, Jada, I love you at the beginning of it was him trying to soften the blow of the joke. But I get from their perspective, why do you have to keep dragging us in front of these white people when your job is to actually be here and drag the white people? Like, why won't you drag them?
Also, if he wanted us on his side, or specifically if he wanted me on his side to start that bit, he should not have referred to Penelope Cruz simply as Javier Bardem's wife. Already that set me off on you can't even say Penelope Cruz's name? Like,
right.
Grim. And then secondly, by the time he gets to Jada Pinkett Smith, here's the thing, as we discussed, whatever he said was probably ad-libbed, but like, I feel like the minute he directs his attention that way, Jada Pinkett is already bracing herself for, oh, here comes a dismissive joke that's probably looks-based. And I think in hearing people talk about how she didn't react, I don't know, properly to the joke or didn't react with a smile, it's like, one, you do not have to find every joke funny. I actually find it pretty radical to just sit there and be like, I'm not going to even give you a smile. Uh-huh. But second of all, it's like, I think there's such a thing as being cliche to the point of nauseating. Like, oh, a woman doesn't have hair, and what like cultural references do we have for that? Just G.I. Jane and Sinead O'Connor, and they're both ancient references, and you made one of them, and you're deemed a comedic genius most of the time, and now we're doing that again while you make the most cliched possible joke.
G.I. Jane, so, he could have, like, the nigga couldn't have made a Black Panther joke. She looks like a Koye. Come on.
So, yeah, though, and then of course, like Will Smith, like sprung into action once he saw the look on Jada Pinkett's face, and that again was confusing for the audience because we didn't see that moment of recognition either. So it was only a minute or so later that we realized what really happened. But like, there's just something about the dismissiveness of that kind of looks-based joke where I'm happy we had a moment to realize actually that was worse than you thought it was. You know, yeah. I think it's a joke that would have just passed with like a couple of giggles from somewhere in the crowd otherwise, but I sort of like that there was a reckoning that sucked even more than the average person would say it did.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, like Ira was saying, it's the context, you know, where, you know, he had done this before, he had done this in front of, you know, in this you know, extremely like ultra Vanta white space before. Is, you know, Will feeling, you know, that this was like the third or fourth joke about them,
yeah,
at night, and I'm sure he, you know, they're on Twitter, they're on IG the same way we all are, and you know, all the jokes about entanglement and August and their relationship and all the memes of his face, and then he has the whole thing with his weight loss journey that was kind of awkward, and then that piece that Wesley Lowery wrote for GQ where you know it was really, you know, revealing and some things you know. Maybe
he's crazy a bit.
Some things that were somewhat unflattering, too.
Yeah.
So you have all of this, right? All of this building up, and then he just tells this throwaway joke, and yeah. I mean, I don't think he should have did that, but I get it. I get why he did. Like, I get why he did.
I kept thinking about like if Wendy Williams was still on the air or something. Like Wendy Williams would have. I think Wendy would have agreed with the hit and been like, come on, Will, you should have done that outside. You know what? Like the slap should have actually came at the before they went into Beyonce and Jay-Z's party. Not on stage. I still think a slap was owed, to be honest. I just don't think he should have done it there. Mostly because now we still have to endure these dumbass conversations about, you know, like respectability politics and like you got friends, like black people talking about black on black crime, light-skinned black people who I know, and I need to block from my phone. You know, it's all very exhausting, but it does make sense in the narrative that we were talking about when we first talked about Will's memoir on the show, Lewis. You know, like he talked about how, you know, like he felt paralyzed by like his mom's abuse and like he wanted to kill his dad. And I'm just like, a man, like if this were a film, we would have seen this moment coming. You know, it's almost like the Joker, right, you right, know, it's right, like he's right. going to snap yeah. at a certain point and kill someone in defense of a woman, you know, because he could have killed Chris Rock, as Judd Apatow said.
And I guess my response to that too is, you know, is was it about defending Jada's honor or was it about his own ego?
It was about his ego. Bruised. It was definitely his ego.
You know, because it didn't, you know, when you, like as you were alluding to, you know, he had his big speech about how he's a protector and how he, you know, that's why he's put on earth to do. But now, before it was just jokes that they got. Now they're getting scrutinized, microscoped. Looking at the relationship, people speculating about whether he's actually abusive, physically abusive to her. Mm-hmm. So it actually made them more of a target, made her more of a target,
yeah.
you know, than yeah. anything, you know. Yeah,
can we talk about how they filmed him during that speech? It was like something out of Nightcrawler, the close-up they chose. Like, I was like fully underneath him, like going up. It was like breaking local news or something. It was very...
It was
confrontationally
intense.
Filmed in a way that, like, say, Jessica Chastain was not filmed.
Yeah.
I saw nostril hair. I definitely saw nostril hair.
We saw snot. We saw yeah. tears. Mm-hmm. It was... Anyway, yeah, it's wild that it took this long for people to start talking about misogyny and Chris Rock in the same conversation, but now women online are doing it. And, you know... Shout out to the alopecia community because, you know, they are rising up as well this week. So
also, I was going to say about the alopecia thing. People keep saying, well, Chris Rock clearly didn't know she had a medical condition. And my response to that, or I think the response to that is, well, now he does. You know? Like, what's the correct way? Oh, he should have been briefed about that, like, by gently by Will Smith. It's like, not really. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well... That was the Will Smith portion of the Oscars.
I truly thought we were going to come out of that Oscars being like, oh, that great speech Troy Kotsur made, or like Yunya Jung introducing him. It's like, now that is so beyond trivia. No one remembers that. It's so shocking how it wiped the entire preceding 2.5 hours away. I've never seen anything in an award show like that before. Yeah,
it was so sweet, by the way, how she like signed Troy's name before he won.
Or I think she said love, maybe. Or maybe yeah. she said Troy.
I can't read sign language.
I noticed.
I had to give myself some recognition really quickly too, because I watched this live. I saw the Moonlight La La Land thing live. I saw the Janet Super Bowl live, and I saw the Malice at the Palace. You know, in the Detroit Pistons and the Indiana Pacers got into the fight with the crowd. I was watching that game live, and so there can't be more than 700 people on Earth who could say that they were watching all four of those things exactly when it happened. So again, I have to acknowledge myself here.
Oh, good.
And give
congrats to you.
Kennedy Center honors forthcoming. Yes,
I just had to say that.
All right, we're going to take a brief break from the Oscars, and Lewis and I are going to chat with the fantastic Judith Light. And then after that, Damon joins us again for more Oscars.
Live life at your pace. Click the banner or go to visitwilliamsburg.com to discover how. Because here in Williamsburg, life moves at one pace, yours. Visit a live archaeological dig site on the very grounds where America began, or walk the fields where our country was won. Live like a colonial by day or track 18th century ghosts by night. For all the history to be found here, there's plenty more to make for yourself. It's all waiting for you in Williamsburg. Book your trip today and live life at your pace.
Our guest today is honestly a legend. Three-time Tony winner, who also happens to have two Emmys. We're talking soap star, sitcom star, Broadway star, and HIV/AIDS activist. Please welcome the Judith Light.
My goodness, that was quite the intro. Thank you so much.
I mean, you've done so much. And you also have done so much for truly us. When I talk about remembering your work, this is maybe going to come as a shock. I used to watch SoapNet after school in high school. You know, that's how I would catch up on like 90210 and Melrose Place. But I also means that I have seen you on One Life to Live multiple times.
My goodness.
And of course, they air your iconic courtroom scene as Karen Wolek all the time. They used to air it all the time when I was in school. So that was sort of my introduction to your greatness as an actress.
Thank you. What a lovely, lovely thing to say. I was going to say, you were probably way too little to see it when it first came out, right?
Yes. Right? But definitely my grandmother who introduced me to soap operas like was familiar with your character.
And didn't everybody's grandmother? I mean, my grandmother was devoted to the soaps. My mother was devoted to the soaps. No, I still have all the VHS recordings that my mother made.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I've got so to
did
do
your,
something.
Did your mom them. Record them for like when you were on? Was it exciting for her for you to be on One Life to Live?
Oh, it was an absolute thrill. It was, look, she got to see me practically every day, which she didn't in real life. So she got to see me do that. So that was helpful for her. So yes.
Is being on a soap opera like a sort of acting military? Like, do you come out of it like utterly primed for anything thrown your way? Because I imagine you just show up on a soap opera set and they're like, well, today, I don't know, like your twin is going to eat you or whatever's going to happen. And you just have to accept it. So what is it like coming off a soap? Do you feel prepared for everything?
What did you say? Acting military? Yes. Is that what you said? That is the most articulate sense of it's the best articulation of the experience. But it's not like, you know, your twin's going to eat you that day. You know in advance, and you've got to, you know, you really have to recognize and give props and kudos to the writers on soaps. They're writing an hour of programming every single day. So you know what the storyline is that's coming. You know if you have 60 pages to learn from the night before. And of course, I was one of those people who didn't know how to read the teleprompter. I couldn't do the teleprompter, you know, even though it was going. I would be like, and so, Jimmy, what? And I would forget the line. And so I would I just couldn't do it. So I had to memorize everything. So yes, what it does is it prepares you to be able to jump into something very quickly. It gives you a sense of being able to do cold readings or auditions quickly. It gives you a sense of the kind of substance that you have to bring to the soap so that it isn't just this superficial thing, but that it's filled with an emotional life that you have to find your way to. And so I would say it was probably after Carnegie Tech, after Carnegie Mellon University and training there, it was probably the best training that I ever had. I mean, repertory theater is another thing, but this is really about how do you jump on board? How do you get on the train quickly? And also you have to be careful that you don't create a bunch of habits that you're going to have to undo afterwards. And that's really hard and daunting to do and challenging as well. And then I really was very disdainful of doing a soap. And then I watched one day and I saw what everybody was doing and I was just overcome. I was in awe of the work that they did. So it's perfect for articulation.
Well, you were also from the era too, where, you know, like I felt like the network still paid money for soaps, you know, and you like, they put care and effort into storylines. I mean, yours in particular was, you know, something that hadn't really been seen on daytime before.
Well, yeah. I mean, what they did was they asked me about this story. When I took over for somebody, she had been ill. And they said, if you did this part, what would you do? And I think they were looking to to recast it because she'd not been well. And they asked me what I thought of the storyline of the movie with Catherine Deneuve, Belle de Jour. Oof. That's where they took that story. And I said, oh, I think that's absolutely genius. And so we talked a lot about that. So yes, they took a lot of care with it. And it was a very, it was a storyline that transversed like a year and a half and involved everybody in the town. So yes, they were very careful with it. And they were very diligent about it. And you talk about having to do a lot of work. 1 hour of programming a day is a lot for a network, for the showrunners, for the directors, for the actors. It's a lot.
If I may, you remind me of someone like Cloris Leachman, and that there is just something sporadically creative about you. Even as I sit here talking to you, you're just like inspired and going and not stopping and not having to think twice. And it's so rad to see. And it makes me wonder, based on all of your roles, which, by the way, none of them have anything in common on stage, on TV, whatever. And you're like an utter chameleon. What kind of role have you done that actually threw you, that made you think like, I need an extra week to even figure out how the fuck I'm going to approach this?
I love that. You guys, you're both really adorable. I don't know. If I say yes to something, I know that I can do it, and I have to do it in a particular amount of time, because that's only respectful to your fellow folk. You don't say, hey, you know, like, I'd like to have a pina colada and sit around and think about this. So you don't have time to do that. And thank you for the Cloris Leachman reference. I really thought her talent was so extraordinary.
Yeah.
Really extraordinary. And I don't know that she ever got the kind of acknowledgement that really was due her. I mean, if you go back and watch Last Picture Show again, it is a classic performance that's still holds up over time. My energy is about, for me, it's about, and it's the same thing that when I'm doing my work, that it's the level of aliveness that comes when I'm engaged with people who are interesting and asking great questions. And so that brings the aliveness and the energy up for me. I'm not always like this. So it has a lot to do with who you both are and the way you ask questions and the way you're operating. So for me, I don't spend time. If I'm going to take something on, I don't say I need another week. Yeah. I never would do that. Look, I mean, over time, what happens is, like when I was doing Other Desert Cities, that brilliant play by John Robin Bates, when I was doing that and Joe Mantello was directing it and I took over for Linda Lavin when it went to Broadway, we worked on that over time. I only had nine rehearsals before I had to go into performance. So Joe Mantello said to me, who is like a genius. And Joe said to me, you know your lines, just know your lines. Don't learn anything emotionally. And I remember him coming to me in the middle of the run, because Joe would come back and like give notes. He gave me a note in the middle of the run that changed everything for an opening monologue. So there's always, with the theater, you always have that kind of ongoing level of creative activity.
This new project that you're in, that's going to be debuting, is Julia, which is of course based on Julia Child, and it's created by Daniel Goldfarb, who was I was able to meet him when I went to Tisch. He wasn't one of my professors, unfortunately, but I did know Daniel Goldfarb back at NYU. And your character of Blanche Knopf, who is, you know, a publishing giant, first of all, is a character who could have her own series, just in knowing her work. You know, like, she didn't just do The Art of French Cooking. You know, she's famously, you know, like, published one of Baldwin's novels, you know, and he, like, famously hated her edits because she tried to make them more palatable to, you know, Americans, and globally, just like not as sort of coarse language that he had in his books. And I think he like rejected having her publish Giovanni's Room because of that. But what sort of research did you do into Blanche, or were you already familiar with her work?
I was not. not familiar with her at all. There's a book called The Lady and the Borzoi, which is the book that I used for most of my research. It's a really detailed account about Blanche, and I was mispronouncing her name. I had to go back and do looping. I was saying Knopf, and it's Knopf, apparently, which is way worse pronunciation. Yeah. I think. But you know, they're
having to say that every day at work.
You know, that they're not going to listen to me. But when I was really shocked, Daniel Goldfarb is just extraordinary, and so is my friend Chris Kaiser, who is also the other creator of the show. And of course, having a playwright like Daniel getting to write for television, and Chris, you know, these people come from the theater, and they're the depth of their writing. And not to say that anybody who doesn't come from the theater isn't substantive and terrific. They happen to be together a really great team. I didn't know about Blanche Knopf, and I was shocked to find out all the details of her life. And yes, I agree with you. She could have her own series, her own story, because this is a woman who really didn't want to do Julia Child's cookbooks. She gave it off. She passed it off to the genius editor, Judith Jones. And what she did was, in 1919, when she married Alfred Knopf, he said to her, "We'll do this together. We'll be the team, and we'll, you know, enter into this publishing empire." He basically shoved her to the side. And at the fifth anniversary of Knopf Publishing, he was like, never really acknowledged her. And it was at that period of time when women were not acknowledged. She was the face of women in publishing at that time. She was extraordinary. And she and Alfred had a very contentious relationship. They were, it is said that he was abusive to her on many different ways, many different levels. And the irony, the tragedy of her was that as she went along in life, and people, I think, do know this about her, she started to go blind. Her whole life was about reading and finding these people. And, you know, I mean, you know, you can understand how Jimmy Baldwin related to her, because she was really impossible and tough. And, you know, Giovanni's Room, we can do a whole other podcast on. I mean, I am a devotee of James Baldwin. So, I mean, there's that, you know, but Blanche was quite an extraordinary human being.
Now, this is one of those TV shows where I'm scrolling down the cast list and I'm just letting out yelps at the people who appear, like, oh my God, Bebe Neuwirth. Oh, Isabella Rossellini. Like, it's painful to read all these wonderful names. Do you have
David Hyde Pierce?
David Hyde Pierce. David. Yes, another Tony winner.
Fran Kranz. I mean, you got people in there.
Yes.
You got some folks.
Do you have just favorite kind of kindred spirit actors who are your friends, who kind of, I don't know, approach the work the same way you do, have the same vigor about it that you do? I imagine in Broadway, there's a ton of people like this, but.
Of course. I mean, you know, there's lots and lots of people. David and I haven't gotten to work together on this show yet. But, you know, it's like, I have this, you know, people always say, how do you have chemistry with somebody? It's like, you make your chemistry with somebody. If somebody works a particular way, I work to work the way that they do, so that we have a mutuality of flow between us, among us. So I don't seek out somebody. There are some people who naturally we work similarly, and it just, you know, there's that ease and that, you know, that language that you have that's instantaneous. But it's not always the case, and you have to be flexible, and you have to find the people. Look, there are people who have tremendous longevity in this business, and they do carry the vigor with them. David Hyde Pierce happens to be one of them. And so there, you know, you find them always along the way. And if you stay open, I find, if you stay open and flexible and aware of yourself and your own shortcomings, then all of a sudden you can work with anybody. This is a team sport. This is a business of service. So you got to put that on out as your context. You just have to. I mean, I just did a movie with Zach Quinto. Zach.
Oh, Down Low, it was written by a friend of ours, Lucas Cage, and Phoebe Fisher. Yeah.
Hello. Come on. Get out of town. I mean, Zach texted me and he said, "You have to do this with us. You have to do this with us." And I said, I don't know. I mean, I don't know if I can do this. And he said, "You can do this. Just like, you know, come to Oyster Bay, New York, and we'll shoot this." And we did. And we had the best time. And that was for Film Nation, for the wonderful Lucas Weissendanger, who I'm doing another film for in Georgia in, like, you know, 2 weeks. So do you know a filmmaker, this young, brilliant African-American filmmaker named Tyresha Poe?
I do not.
No.
Honeys, you've got to look it up. Oh, my God. This human is on fire.
I'm looking her up now. I saw Sela in the Space.
Yes.
Great film.
She was lauded at Sundance. She wrote this new film called The Young Wife that Kiersey Clemons is in. I mean, it's really, really special, odd, creative. You know, you talk about, you know, creative vigor. This is where it is. So, you know, I get to do things like this with that are really exciting to me.
Now, Judith, like, do you just have like a I picture a stack of like unread plays and things that you just like generally pull from? Are you constantly reading up on what's happening, et cetera?
Do you mean like, do I read new things?
Or new and old things?
I read anything I can get my hands on. And particularly when I'm in the process of creating character, I'm looking at myself. I'm looking at what I have in my life, what I can bring, where I am right now in my life. And also always, always, always historical references, always plays that are old, that are new, that are, you know, seeing something, you know, watching something on television series, whatever it might be, that begins to filter. You know, it's like you come alive with other people's creativity. I think there's a spark of their creativity that ignites with the spark of you. And I was just reading this book called The Illusion of Life and Death. I think that's pretty what it's called. I think her last name is Goldsberry, and it's like, I'm playing this character in Tyresha's film, a woman who has a very complex life, and I won't go into it, but I mean, you know, we can come back and talk to each other again once we know it's going to be coming out. And it's about life and death. And what does that mean? And so when I start to infuse myself with those thoughts, that kind of thinking, and translate it into what Joan Scheckle, who is this genius person who worked with us on creating on when we were creating our characters on this show that I did for Amazon called Transparent. I don't know if you ever saw it.
Oh, sure did. Yes.
Right. You know, not everybody sees everything, so you know, you gotta ask. So, Joan always talked about taking whatever something was that didn't live in your head only and in your intellect and in your intelligence, but lived in your body and the physicality of the that, you know, emotion, she said, rides on the blood and the water of the body. And if you can find your way in there with yourself and with other people, all of a sudden you'll begin to have a very different kind of, you won't be saying, all right, at this moment I'm going to do this, and at this moment I'm going to do that. You have this flow that begins to happen in a way that's more alive, more tactile, more unusual. Mm.
Great. If I could ask you one last thing. You're so well known for your dramatic roles, but I feel like you also started early on with, you know, you did Who's the Boss, which was, you know, sitcom, and you sort of had to flex your comedic muscles. And then, of course, Ugly Betty, which is an iconic role of yours. How did you find, you know, like, comedic timing?
Comedic timing is like music. You hear it or you don't. Mm. And when you can have somebody as great with comedy as Tony Danza is, that you can learn from and watch and observe. And I had done a bunch of comedies in theater, in repertory theater, because when I left Carnegie, I went into repertory theater. And so I did comedies there. You have to hear it. And if you don't hear it, you can never get that timing right. But it really mm-hmm. is like music. And so I think they knew that I could be funny. I had come from the soap, and then I got the Who's the Boss. But Tony really was a great teacher and a guide for me on all of that. But I could hear it before. He would say, don't, like when the audience would laugh, he taught me how to hold for a laugh. So that was something that I really relished and cherished. And I love him a lot. So.
I think about that moment on sitcoms all the time when the audience is laughing and you just have to do something between movement and not saying your next line. It would feel incredibly awkward to me, but I guess you just get used to it.
You remember your audience is the other part of your show. It's not, they're not like these foreign things. They're integral to the production, just like the camera is. You know, it's not an intrusion, it's an inclusion. So when you have that, when you hold it like that, it's a very different experience. It's like, oh good, you're participating with us, you're in the show. So it you know, I mean, it could feel awkward for a minute, but not really, not to me. No, not really. For some people, it can be a challenge, and then you learn how to do it, and then you know that's what you do. That's part of your job.
Well, thank you so much, Judith, for being here. I mean, it was truly an honor. I just want to
like throw my hands up and listen to you all day. My God, you were like a full like Gatorade of endorphins. Yeah.
you're so darling. I thought we would have a little bit more time. Did you all want to talk about Shining Vale at all? Have you heard about that or seen that? Where I play Courtney Cox's mother
and our
stars?
Friend Maren Dungy is on that too.
Yes, that's right. Wait till you see this. Julia is brilliant. And so is this. I'm so proud to be in both of these shows. I'm telling you, Courtney Cox and Greg Kinnear. This show is comedy and drama and horror, all rolled into one. And they're dealing with a ton of women's issues. And I don't even know how you do that, like menopause and marital sexual relationships and mental illness. It's a triple somersault. So I would encourage viewing.
I mean, I have been such a fan of Courtney Cox. So obviously, you know, like growing up with Friends, but also, you know, Scream and then Cougar Town. Like she's done so much.
Wait till you see her in
I'm
this.
I'm so excited.
She's really, really different. And the other thing that I would tell you about is that I was in Savannah, Georgia for a couple of months back last year, and I did a film called The Menu that with Ralph Fiennes and Anya Taylor-Joy and like my friend Reed Burney, whose daughter Gus Burney is in The Shining Vale, and directed by the genius Mark Mylod, who directs Succession. Really, really interesting piece, something that I think you all are going to want to see. And then I'm producing a bunch of stuff too, and producing some stuff to my husband. Yeah.
Imagine if you didn't have 90 projects going on at once. I could not be less surprised.
Yeah.
You're very sweet. And I'm really happy to talk to you, and thank you for the wonderful questions. You guys are really great.
Oh, of course.
Really, of course.
Also, by the way,
how's the podcast going? How's it doing?
Oh, we do. Great. We do this a good job. Don't you worry.
Yeah, we started this in January of 2018, so you know it's been and we do it every week.
Why don't I know about this? I mean, this is like when they told me about it, I said intersectionality, which is what I loved about, you know, pop culture and the world and all of that stuff, and you know, all of the, you know, the stuff that comes up a lot around the LGBTQ stuff that we like to talk about. So that's really important, you know.
Yeah.
We keep it pretty gay here, so don't worry about that. Yeah.
I saw somebody's nails.
Pretty. Yes.
Thank you, guys.
Thank
you. What a pleasure, Jerry.
Yes. No, come back anytime.
Yeah, you want to be the third co-host? Whatever. Come back. Yeah.
Thank you. We'd love to come back. Thank you so much. Be well. Yes. Stay well, guys.
Yes. Talk to you soon.
Live life at your pace. Click the banner or go to visitwilliamsburg.com to discover how. Because here in Williamsburg, life moves at one pace, yours. Here, our waters are splashing and rejuvenating. Our history is for seeing and experiencing. Our theme parks are for riding and sometimes flying. And our great outdoors are yours for exploring and restoring. It's all waiting for you in Williamsburg. Book your trip today and live life at your pace.
All right, we're back with Damon, and we're going to kick off this convo with another brief moment that happened at the Oscars, which was the 30th anniversary of White Men Can't Jump, which is an appropriate anniversary to celebrate because it's 30 years, even though it was weird having the Oscars celebrate White Men Can't Jump during the ceremony, a film that I'm positive was ignored when it came out 30 years ago by the Academy.
Yeah, and it's like to kind of overcorrect, they celebrated the 28th anniversary of Pulp Fiction. And if someone misses your 28th birthday, right, it's not a big deal. Like, in fact, if one of my friends missed my 28th birthday and it's like, you know what, I had some engagement, I couldn't show up. I'm like, you know what, show up for my 30th, right? Because that's the number that matters. 28 and all these fucking nebulous ass off-brand numbers that are celebrated as anniversaries, they don't matter. Like, no one gives a shit about the 28th anniversary, the 17th anniversary, the 6th anniversary. You keep it 1st, 5th, 10th, 15th, 20th, just factors of 5 going forward. After number one, you just go by factors of 5 going forward. Because again, these off-year, off-brand anniversaries just annoy the shit out of me. And I just had to say that.
Also, I think the thing is, everyone has a birthday every single year. Mm-hmm. So it's to quote-unquote celebrate a random number is to celebrate nothing. Simply the way time works. And if they had just said, oh, we're reuniting the cast of Pulp Fiction, that would have been fine. Ooh. But instead, they put this number in front of it, which cheapened the fact that they were there. Even like 15 years for Juno, it was cool to see Elliot Page, but also it's like you couldn't get Alice and Janney in there. You know, I'm texting Diablo Cody. I'm like, look, they just said your name. And then she like sprung into action. She's like, what? Yeah.
I mean, it was extra weird for me to bring the Juno cast out for celebrating Juno's screenplay win. I was like, the Oscars really does not give a fuck about screenwriters, do they? I was expecting Diablo to walk out. And she's famous enough as a writer in her own right that she could have walked out on stage with them and people would have clapped for her. Mm-hmm.
Instead, we got 11'4" Jennifer Garner lording over the cast of Juno. I didn't realize that J.K. Simmons was apparently like 4'8".
Yeah. And you know what? Elliot Page is looking good. Mm-hmm. Elliot Page has got a chin, by the way. That's a good jawline.
Has a very, now you're fixated. Very strong, very Batman, very, very Wayne-esque jawline.
Yes, yes.
Happening
okay.
There. Yeah.
Let's definitely get that twist. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's get that Batman.
There's an opening for Robin.
That's true. That's true.
Right.
Is there a Rob? I haven't seen the Batman yet, but is there a Robin there yet?
No, there's not one in this one.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. There's no. Boom. There we go. We just cast it so, Robin, the next Batman.
So aside from arbitrary anniversaries, which feels very much like when I worked at BuzzFeed, and they would just be like, we need to write about something this week. So I would just look at the calendar and be like, what movies came out this week? And it doesn't matter what year it is. And so then you're celebrating, like, you know, the 11th anniversary of 13 going on 30. Like, anyone cares? But it's just to get people sharing Jennifer Garner clips. Damon, you wrote about White Men Can't Jump, which is being rebooted, starring Jack Harlow, everyone's new favorite white rapper, at least Kanye's favorite white rapper of the moment. Yeah.
And who's my favorite white rapper, Ira?
That would be Madonna.
Madonna, that's correct. Go ahead.
But you wrote about this for the Washington Post because you had some thoughts about how it was miscast.
Yeah, I used to hate just the whole concept of reboots, you know, because it's the whole like nostalgic Uncanny Valley thing that they have going on. It's like, if I want to watch that movie again, I will just watch the movie again instead of, you know, seeing like a replication of it or seeing an update, you know, these characters that we fell in love with 30 years ago are now like 60. And not there's anything wrong with being 60. I hope to be 60 one day also. But yeah, I'm just generally annoyed with the concept of the reboots. And I had to kind of work myself out of that because they bring people joy, apparently. I'm not the audience for them, but someone out there likes these things. So they keep getting made.
And someone likes those damn Disney ones. I have not. I do not watch the live action Disney ones. I watched Lion King because of Beyonce.
A billion people. The Lion King made a band. So someone watched the live action Lion King. Someone did. So they're rebooting White Men Can't Jump, which again is a curious movie to reboot. But again, I'm not going to be mad at it because, you know, all right, whatever. But I read somewhere that they were going to wrap this movie around Jack Harlow, that he was going to star in I guess the Woody Harrelson role in that movie. And I am diametrically opposed to this casting, and it's not even because of Harlow's acting chops. He could be the next Brando, could be the next Daniel Day-Lewis. It's that I saw him play in a celebrity basketball game, the All-Star Celebrity Basketball Game in February, and he is a terrible basketball player.
And so
there's that. It's like, if you're going to cast an actor who is supposed to be good enough, who's to portray a character who is good enough at basketball that he could game and hustle actual ball players, then you should find an actor who is good enough at basketball that could game and hustle actual ball players. And Jack Harlow runs like Frankenstein. He shoots the basketball like his elbows are made of bacon bits. He dribbles the ball he dribbles the ball like it has measles. And again, there's nothing wrong with any of that.
Measles.
Right. There's nothing like not everyone's going to be a great basketball player, and that's fine. But again, if you are going to be cast as someone who is supposed to be good at basketball, you need to be good at basketball. Right.
And also just the casting of athletes in general in old movies is very interesting because it's so the amount of editing that has to be done to even make like basic athletic gestures look great is really impressive. I mean, like, I'm still impressed with, and I wish more people talked about, the tennis playing in King Richard. Like Sanaa Sidney, that girl, I believe she was playing tennis. That was very shocking to me. But anyway, I'll let you go.
No,
to
no,
what
this
we're
is
saying.
That gets to the point. And there, I feel like there are enough actors who can hoop. Like Woody Harrelson was actually not bad. So Woody Harrelson was actually a decent choice in the original. Right. Wesley Snipes was terrible, and we could get into that at another day. Like he hooped. Like, he played basketball like he learned how to play basketball by listening to Curtis Blow's basketball. Like, he had never watched basketball before in his life.
Which is not technically instructions on basketball either. Yes.
What do you think of Denzel in He Got Game?
Denzel had a decent old man's game.
Okay.
Right? And he's matched up against Ray Allen, who's, you know, obviously a NBA star. And, you know, that there's a scene in He Got Game where they play one-on-one, I think, in the movie. Right. And Ray Allen apparently was supposed to beat him, you know, 10-0. But Denzel actually, like, literally really scored those first two baskets.
Oh, damn.
He wasn't supposed to in the script, but that wasn't written in. But Denzel actually scored those baskets on Ray Allen. And you could see Ray Allen's face, you know, Jesus Stutterworth's face getting like more and more pissed off because of that. So Denzel can actually hoop a little bit. Mershara Ali played Division I basketball.
Right.
So you could, there are actors who can play basketball. Jason Segel apparently was known as Dr. Dunk in high school, wherever he went to high school. Yeah. And so why find someone who could hoop? That's my whole thing.
I will say the alternate, though, is sometimes when you cast a movie with like an athlete and you try and be like, I'm going to get the person who can actually do this role. Sometimes they are an abysmal actor. In the case of Steven Soderbergh's Haywire, when he put Gina Carano in that movie because she was an MMA fighter. First of all, she cannot act. And then two, during the pandemic, revealed herself as like an anti-vax MAGA demon. So thank you for that, Steven Soderbergh.
She was, of course, on the American Gladiators reboot in 2008 with Layla Ali, where she played a gladiator named, I believe, Crush. And that was exactly the acting zone for her, where it was mostly about flexing your muscles and being near a wall. Yeah.
Yeah. Ronda Rousey was in, I think, Fast 6 or Furious 7. One of those.
She was good.
Yeah, she was in a role where she didn't have to have that much range. Where, you know, we just need you to get your ass kicked, you know, for about 5 minutes and then you'll be, and then glower, you know, at the screen a little bit and maybe flex and then you'll be off screen. And so again,
she, I believe, was in the Entourage movie too, where I want to say she did okay. Ronda Rousey, weird pop cultural moment that sort of just went away. But anyway,
the Entourage movie was also a good film.
I laughed, unfortunately, and you know, I'll say it, that television show, not my brand. So
the sweet spot. So instead of getting athletes, you know, who are trying to act, or actors who are not athletic, or you just find the actors who are athletic, and there are enough actors who have, you know, who are decent at basketball, or decent at football, or played baseball in high school, that you could cast in these roles instead of trying to shoehorn, you know, someone with a nice curl pattern in, just because of, you know, their current relevance.
That's fair. Did you know that Jason Sudeikis was on his high school basketball team?
I did not know that, but that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
LeBron James and Trainwreck, like, that was an A-minus performance.
LeBron wasn't bad.
I'm looking up celebs who like have played basketball now. So
LeBron was not bad in Trainwreck. LeBron was not bad.
He was actually funny in Trainwreck that I was shocked that he was so awful in Space Jam 2.
Right. I like him as sort of a featured player in a movie. Like, don't like rest the movie on. Mind you, I haven't watched Michael Jordan in Space Jam recently. I wonder how that holds up. Because he
absolutely terrible.
You know what's interesting about him? When he was in like Hanes commercials, he had like a stodgy delivery that worked for him. Like you believed him spouting a tagline or something. But then if that turned into, shall we say, a powerful monologue in a movie, maybe that would be worse.
He hosted SNL. And there's only one skit that I remember, the Stuart Smalley skit. And he was
very funny.
He was great in that. And his deadpan, you know, I'm 6'6", 220 pound delivery actually was perfect. For that skit. So
yes, I remember Stuart Smalley saying, "Do you ever just get up and think I can't play basketball today?" It was so good. They tried turning that into a movie, which was of course abysmal. But man, that's like a great. I think the top tier of '90s SNL sketches.
Great. I mean, speaking of sketches and then basketball, I mean, maybe it doesn't need to go beyond the Dave Chappelle sketch, Prince playing basketball, but I do think that basketball should play heavily in a Prince biopic whenever we get one. And I would love to find the person who could play Prince and could also play basketball well.
Wow. That's going to be tough to find someone who is able to, I don't know, that overlap of
You have to be teensy and agile. So
can Janelle Monáe play basketball?
Someone androgynous and also really great at basketball. Mm-hmm. Wait, what did you
say? Can Janelle Monáe play basketball? Because if Janelle Monáe could play basketball, I'd be here for like an I'm not there kind of.
Okay. All right. I could see that.
I want to say she's tall, though. Am I wrong?
No, she's Janelle Monáe is very short. She's short.
Oh, is she? Yeah. Didn't know.
Yeah. She's like, yeah, I would she's think like she's slightly like 5'1", taller than Quinta.
5'2".
Wow. All right. With our Kylies and our Shakiras, those people.
Yeah, she's 5 foot. Yeah, so.
Oh. Shout out, by the way, to one of my favorite basketball performances. And by that, I mean the rare case of a queer person being cast as a somewhat superstar athlete. In Jane Fonda's first movie, Anthony Perkins was played a basketball player. It's called Tall Story. He is all elbows. I understand that among like athletes, basketball players are gangly. Excuse me. This person is just a heap and pile of joints running around that court with his like cute gayish sneer. Check it out.
I will do that. I try to catalog all of the basketball movies. I try to watch them and I assess them, you know, one for, you know, artistic, you know, rigor, but also just for basketball. And whether the basketball is realistic. And of the ones that I've seen, the best basketball in movies, number one is Above the Rim. Mm-hmm. Because you had actors who could actually play. Dwayne Martin was actually played in college. Now we have to admit, you know, that they played on 8 foot rims too. So some of the dunks that they were doing were just, you know, just not possible for people that size. But again, Above the Rim was number one. Number two is actually a pretty, you know, surprising choice, and that's Finding Forrester.
Oh, my gosh. I haven't seen that since it came out. Yeah.
Wait, I love Finding Forrester, and I rewatched Finding Forrester a year ago for some reason, mostly because I'd forgotten that Gus Van Sant directed this film, and I was like, it's probably much better than I remember, and I watched it. And it is a really good movie that was marred in pop culture by the "You're the man now, dog" line. Like people sort of remember it being dumb.
Basically,
yes,
yeah. And Rob Brown, I think is his name.
Rob Brown.
They casted him basically because he could hoop. They just saw him as they wanted him to be an extra. Because they saw him and his boys playing basketball. And then they're like, well, you're charismatic, you're tall, you're handsome. Why don't you want to be the lead in this? I think that's how the story went. But yeah, he is actually good. And they casted, you know, young actors around him to, you know, in these basketball scenes, guys who actually knew how to play or conceivably be high school basketball players. So again, Finding Forrester and Above the Rim, and then a huge drop off. Huge, tremendous drop off to White Men Can't Jump.
I saw Hoosiers for the first time recently. Do you know what surprises me about that movie, or I guess shouldn't surprise me? It is exactly the template of a basketball movie, as in there's not one added thing that makes it like different. We're like, oh, and there's a woman who does something interesting. No, it's just down the line. We end on this moment with this game, etc. It's so shocking. But the acting, of course, is Dennis Hopper. I think we were talking about him in regards to Apocalypse Now a few weeks ago. He does bring it.
I hope that, you know, maybe for White Men Can't Jump, they make the first basketball movie with no basketball played in it. That would be radical. Just have the basketball alluded to. Just have them sitting on the sidelines. Have them in a locker room. Have them on the bleachers.
That's kind of what the movie Moneyball
was. Actually,
you know,
like, show the basketball.
Right. The movie Moneyball was sort of like the idea of baseball is happening off screen somewhere. Here we are in a darkened gray room talking about what should be occurring in baseball, but we're not going to make it up. We're not going to show you it.
Mm-hmm. So to close out, I will see what Damon's opinion of my two of my favorite basketball films. Not serious basketball films, but Teen Wolf and Just Right.
Yeah, see, so with Just Right, okay, I've never been able to get into that movie specifically because Common is supposed to be not just a basketball player, not just an NBA player, but an NBA star. Right.
He's also supposed to be an actor, and he has never proven this in any film. Despite the fact that I like him on camera.
I feel like Colman has found a little niche as like being a hitman who dies eventually.
He is great in the John Wick films. Like
five times. I can't suspend my belief enough for that movie to work for me, because Colman is just not good enough at basketball for it. And it just that takes me out of the whole movie. Now Teen Wolf is different because again he's a teen werewolf. Okay,
so says it right in the title.
So you're the belief is suspended already that you have a teen werewolf in high school, and this is and it's not even like a big deal, right? Isn't that the biggest story in the world, right? It's just like a local, you know, this teen just has a lot of hair and he's a werewolf and he could jump really high, but like the entire universe is shut down to focus on this high school.
No one had a 1985 the way Michael J. Fox had a 1985. Yeah. Teen Wolf, Family Ties, and Back to the Future.
Michael J. Fox, he had a goat year, you know. And the worst, though, I'll just leave with this. The worst ever basketball depiction in a movie that I've seen is American History X. And there's a scene. There's a scene when the Aryans, the white supremacists led by, what's his name, Edward Norton, character, they challenge a bunch of black people at a playground to play, you know, 5-on-5, and it's like whoever wins gets to rule the playground and the park in the area, and the white supremacists win. But anyway, the game ends with Edward Norton's character doing a double punt reverse dunk. Okay, like an NBA contest level dunk. Right.
Yeah, rock and jock basketball.
Yes, like NBA Jam, rock, like boom, boom, dunking it, and they win, and they tell they niggers get the fuck off the court, and again, it's a moment that did not need to exist. Okay, the rest of the movie, whatever, but they could have taken that scene. That scene should have been left in drafts.
You know the wildest thing about American History X is, Sam Rockwell must have seen that movie and been like, that's the role I want to play in every movie.
He's like, how can I turn this into a track that I ride?
All right. When we're back, it's time for Keep It. And we are back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Damon, you're our guest of honor, so why don't you go first?
Yeah, so, you know, as we know, you know, there is a book ban epidemic that is going across the country right now. School board members, parents, politicians are trying to ban anything that tries to subvert or counter or contradict their own notions of white supremacy, you know, and a lot of it's the usual suspects. I mean, you have, you know, Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, Alice Walker's The Color Purple, but also some contemporaries too. Friends of mine, Kiese Layman's Heavy has been banned a lot. Nicole Hannah-Jones' The 1619 Project is like, I feel like they all have that, her picture on like dartboards in her house right now. George Johnson, All Boys Are Blue, Ijeoma Olu's book, Ibram Kendi. So you just go down the line. And at this point, there's going to be nothing left to read except for Tom Clancy and like the label on a bottle of Dr. Bronner's peppermint soap. That's all that's going to be left in schools. And so that's not even my gripe. That's not even my issue. My issue is that my book, What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker, came out 3 years ago. Okay, the first six pages alone, I talk about naked white people. I have multiple slurs. I talk shit about Tom Cruise. I talk about the link between masturbation and prayer. And yet my book still has not been banned.
that fucking sucks. I really have to say I'm with you on this one.
Right. And so I have book ban FOMO, and my whole thing is like, what do I have to do? You know, is my book not radical enough? Is my book not black enough for these motherfuckers to ban it? And so going through this in my head, and this is a real thing too. Like, I'm not joking. I want my book to be banned. Like, you know, I have a couple of books that are in the works right now, and forget about pre-orders. I want you, everyone listening, to sign a petition to pre-ban my book. But I feel like this is just more proof that these books aren't actually getting read. Right.
Where they're not.
The books that are banned, you know, it's like, okay, I saw an excerpt, or I heard a thing, or this thing, someone else read it, and it made me feel a certain way. And so we must ban it from our district. We must ban it from these curriculums. We must go out and burn them. And again, it sucks that my book isn't one of those books being banned. But again, it just helps to expose the ridiculousness of this whole epidemic of banning and burning and trying to just, you know, keep America as white and as stupid as possible.
No, that's the ticket for an author. You gotta get the book banned. You gotta get the book banned. That's the only reason we talk about Mark Twain anyway, because those books aren't good.
Right. Mm. Oh, hard take.
That's a take. Okay.
A Connecticut hot take in King Arthur's Court. My God.
Twain takes, okay.
The only racist Twain I love is Shania.
Anyway, Lewis, what is your keep it this week?
My keep it is to a certain type of tweet, but one that has reared its head again this week in regards to the Oscars. It was written by David Sirota, Oscar-nominated co-writer of Don't Look Up, which won exactly zero Oscars, which some people enjoy. His tweet was, "My thoughts on the Oscar slap incident are that it's 70 degrees in Antarctica and what's left of the livable ecosystem is being destroyed, and so we should focus on that." Are you literally saying don't react to a slap you just watched by surprise on television? Don't say one thing about it. Start thinking about Antarctica immediately. Let's think about how like human brains work. If you can be confronted with one thing and still have convictions about anything else existing in the world. This reminds me of when Michael Jackson died. Somebody I knew from college said something like, "I can't believe people are talking about Michael Jackson when instead they could be talking about, I don't know, whatever roar was going on there." It's like, you do realize that by bringing up one topic, you are not negating the existence of another topic. Mm-hmm. It's just the shallowest condescension possible, which is to say, you have one concern, but there are other concerns, and therefore you're stupid. It's just like taking an easy chance to call people dumb, when instead, if you really care about Antarctica, you don't have to bring up the Oscar slap. You can just talk about it, and then maybe we'll retweet that, you know? So easy condescension in general is like a real pet peeve of mine, and especially from somebody who is probably jilted his nomination didn't turn into a win.
Also, did he go to the Oscars after party? Did he go to the Vanity Fair party? Because he really should have gone home to continue the work of, you know, saving the polar ice caps. You know, you made your movie, which was to get the word out there. Now get back to work.
Right. Get back to Antarctica, Ernest Shackleton, or whatever your effing journey is.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Greta Thunberg was texting me about the slap. So shut up, David.
Right. She's like, "I think it was faked." Yeah.
Yeah. It's just people whose entire public existence is predicated on being deterred and punchable at all times. It's like, yeah, we get it. Fucking Neil deGrasse Tyson. Like, okay, there are more important things to talk about. Nikola fucking Tesla. But we all watch this thing, and this is what we're talking about right now. It doesn't mean that you can't have your fucking greenhouse effect, ozone layer tweets off any other time. You could get them off, but right now, we don't give a shit.
And Ira, what is your keep it?
My keep it goes to Maude Apatow's dad, determined.
Oh, Judd, yes.
Yeah, who is determined to embarrass her on the internet forever. During the show, after the slap, Judd Apatow saw black people being black and decided that once again he couldn't mind his own business and hopped on the internet to tweet, he could have killed him. That's pure out of control rage and violence. They've heard a million jokes about them in the last 3 decades. They are not freshmen in the world of Hollywood and comedy. He lost his mind.
First of all, your reading of it and the text itself was giving 80s thriller movie trailer.
Lots of gravitas. Yeah, lots of gravitas right here. Just had this. Yeah,
it was very the movie Sea of Love or something.
Yeah, this is right.
I am so tired of Judd Apatow. What possessed any of this tweet besides being kind of racist?
I mean, he could have killed them is so vague.
Rage and violence. He lost his mind. This was like, and this wasn't even the insane people who were not even going to address who were tweeting like that doctor who had that viral tweet where she was like, if it had been Betty White on stage, then he'd slapped. People love hypotheticals on the internet that have absolutely nothing to do with what actually just happened. But to suggest that that slap in that moment could have killed Chris Rock, that, you know, it was King Kong marching up the Empire State Building to rip Chris Rock apart is wild. And it reminds me that, like, Judd Apatow always has weird energy for black men. You know, we've talked about it on Keep It, like, years ago. But, like, throughout the entire, like, Harvey Weinstein and, like, Woody Allen thing, it's like, you, of course, get, like, a tweet from him or something. But he was, like, every day blogging about Bill Cosby. Mm. Like, daily blogging. To the point where it's like, okay, Busy Phillips came out and said that, like, James Franco threw her to the ground on the set of your show, Freaks and Geeks, and you do nothing about it. And you all sort of laughed it off when she talked about it in this panel, but yet you're hopping on your phone every 5 seconds to talk about Bill Cosby. It's just very weird. And the fixation with Cosby in the height of, like, stuff going on with Woody Allen and Harvey Weinstein was just very, like, okay, you're focused on, like, the black man who you're obsessed with right now. And then this tweet about Will Smith was, like, I don't know. It felt like Joseph Conrad wrote it.
Yeah, like, you know, like what you were saying earlier in the show, it's like they're pretending like white-on-white violence doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And, you know, we see it. I've seen it in front of me. I went to a Catholic school in middle school, and I would see white on white violence. I would see white on white slurs I didn't even know existed. You know,
yes.
Italians with slurs for Greeks, and Greeks with slurs for Poland. I like, oh shit, this is a whole new world of slurs for me.
I did not learn WAP until I went to an all white school. Okay, and my Catholic all boys high school had people calling like Italian students like that, and I was like, what is happening here?
Yeah. Yeah. And so white on white balance is a thing. And so these people getting on, you know, getting on Kyrie Irving's internet to act all Pollyanna about all this shit. It's not. Yeah. It's like, again, why are you doing this? Why are you pretending? Why are you perpetrating right now when we know that this is, I mean, if you're a comedian, you know, Apatow grows up. Going to these comedy clubs, I'm sure he's seen fights. I'm sure he's seen people get smacked on stage before. I mean, he's probably been smacked. Like, you don't come up through that world of stand up and, you know, all these men being like hyper competitive and, you know, for spots and for maybe movies and all that, and not see these sorts of physical altercations. Maybe they don't lead to like actual like injury or death, but he has seen fights as an adult before. He has seen people fighting on stage before. You cannot grow up in that world and not see that.
Damon, thank you so much for being here with us today. Everyone should go and listen to Stuck with Damon Young on Spotify. It is a Crooked and Gimlet joint, and it's great.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me on this podcast. Again, this was a lot of fun. Stuck with Damon Young is available. It's exclusive to Spotify, so you can only listen to it on Spotify. But please, you know, you get a chance, check it out. you know, hopefully, you know, I have the same legs that Cupid has had. That's one of my goals.
Fingers crossed this podcast gets banned too.
Definitely. Ban my podcast.
Yeah. Please. Well, on the plus side, it's just stuck with Damon Young. So you won't go through as many co-hosts as we have.
we're like solid gold up in here.
Also, thank you to Judith Light for being here. And we will see you next week for more Keep It.
Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James. Our producer is Caroline Reston. And our associate producer is Brian Semmel. Our executive producer is Ira Madison III. But I, Louis Fertel, do a good job too. Our audio engineers are Charlotte Landis and Kyle Seglin, and the show is mixed and edited by Charlotte Landis. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Melkonian, and Milo Kim for production support every week.
Live life at your pace. Click the banner or go to visitwilliamsburg.com to discover how. Because here in Williamsburg, life moves at one pace, yours. Visit a live archaeological dig site on the very grounds where America began. Or walk the fields where our country was won. Live like a colonial by day or track 18th century ghosts by night. For all the history to be found here, there's plenty more to make for yourself. It's all waiting for you in Williamsburg. Book your trip today and live life at your pace.